Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of August. Our guest this hour is a foster mother, and she also has spent 5 years looking at foster families, foster parents, biological parents, people who work in the child welfare system, and it's an extraordinary book that she has written that is titled To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. She knows so much about the system, not only from research, but of course from personal experience as well. She became a foster parent to one of her students, a 17-year-old named Christina. And Christina's story is also quite something, so we'll talk about that. Chris is the author of Transparent, which covers 7 years in the lives of four transgender teenagers. She's author of IMJ, a novel for young adults, and a memoir, Mother Stranger. She teaches creative writing at Columbia University and Bayview Correctional Facility, and she is with us this hour to talk about the foster care system in this country. We'll be welcoming phone calls with a special request to those of you who may be foster parents or somehow you've been in contact with the foster care system. Maybe that's the way you grew up, or you were in foster care for a few years, or you work in that system as well. We'd really like to hear from you this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Chris, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Really, what an interesting book. I'm so glad you wrote it, because it's an important book, isn't it? You must have felt when you finished it, I'm glad I told this story. It needs to be heard, which it does.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's, you know, I kind of just was able to turn up the volume on some conversations that were going on, and there really are so many more going on. You know, I felt like, you know, the first draft that I turned into my poor editor was about 600 pages. And, you know, it could have been longer. So, yeah, I feel like it's a conversation that needs to be ongoing.
Right. Well, there's always book two and three and four.
Yeah. Yeah. Watch out.
Right. Let's start with a story, because I love these stories of, you know, mother and child reunion story. Yeah. The story of you and Christine and where you were when she came into your life. And obviously this really developed a keen interest in the whole foster care system. Tell me about Christina.
Christina's great. I was just on the phone with her, actually. You know, I was really young. I was 28 at the time. I was a high school teacher. I had no intention of becoming a parent at that point in my life. And she had been a student in my high school, and I really, really cared about her. She was, you know, bright and smart and funny and sassy, and I was teaching in a school where there were a lot of foster kids. So I knew something about the foster care system, just, you know, anecdotally through these kids. And then, because she was in foster care, like a lot of kids, she got put in another group home and got yanked out of my school, put into another school. But, you know, I just kept in touch with her because there was something really special about her. And I was a little worried about her. She's transgender, and I was a little worried that she was getting yanked around a bit much. A lot of the transgender and gender-variant kids in foster care, as you probably know, they're often not placed very well. They're placed according to the gender that they were assigned at birth. So Christina was put into, you know, group homes where she'd be rooming with boys, and, you know, that wasn't very safe for her. There
right.
weren't very many places where they could put her that was safe. So there was only one group home that was sort of okay, and they put her in that group home, and that meant she had to change schools. And when they went there, when she went there, they put her also into a probation school, which really didn't make sense. And it was a very dangerous school. And so I was worried about her. So she and I kept in touch. And at this probation school, she was attending as a girl, obviously, and none of the kids knew that she had been born biologically male. And the administrators knew because they had her transcripts, and they told a guard that she had been born biologically male. And the guard told some of the gangster kids.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and the gangsters threatened to kill her. And they would have. And so she called her group home and said, "Oh, my God, they're going to kill me." you know, you better come get me. And they said, well, the van's in use. We can't come get you. It's always about a van in foster care. They said, the van's in use. And so she ran away. She ran from the school before the school day was over, which was a violation of the rules and a violation of her group home rules, because it's always about rules, and she ran away. And because of that, they put out a warrant for her arrest and gave away her bed, and she called me in a panic. She said, you know, what? They put out a warrant. What's happening? And I said, but this is outrageous. This is insane, you know. This was a violation of your safety. Mm-hmm. I'll pick you up. Come over. We'll figure this out. We're going to call your agency. I'm sure this is all just kind of snowballing madness, you know. So I picked her up. We ordered Thai food, calmed down, you know. Thought, you know, here I am thinking, I'm sure we can work this out. I'm 28 thinking I can go up against this huge system, no problem. You know, tuck her in for the night. We don't get a hold of anybody. Tuck her in, you know, calm her down. She watches a movie. The next day we finally get in touch with some of the agency workers and her probation officer, and they say, nope, we're putting her into juvenile hall. We have nowhere else to put her. And I said, she didn't commit a crime. You can't juvenile hall. And they said, well, we don't have any other beds. So, you know, it'll get wiped off her record at 18. But, you know, and I said, that's crazy. And they said, well, you want to keep her? And I said, oh. So that's how it that's how it happened. It was like an unplanned pregnancy.
Now that I've heard this story, which I hadn't heard before, Chris, I know that she said later to you, you saved her life. Indeed, that could be the case, right? You may have saved her life.
Yeah, I mean, she said that to me later. You know, we then went through a couple of years of struggle. It wasn't immediate that she was saying that to me. But yeah, and you know, at first I would say to her, you know, you really saved your own life, because she's really a powerful, powerful person. I mean, it takes a tremendous strength of character for her to get through the life that she's had. And I have so much respect and love for this person. But then I realized, you know, I also needed to take that in, because it took, you know, for a while, she was so broken. She'd been in the system since she was 7. Mm-hmm. She was so broken that she couldn't really show gratitude. And that's the thing that's really tough with a lot of foster kids that I've seen. I mean, everybody's different. I don't want to make global statements. But, you know, at the beginning, sometimes you see new foster parents taking in kids, and they kind of expect or hope that the kids will be grateful for the job that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And these kids are hard, you know, because they've been traumatized. Mm-hmm. And they're not grateful. They're mad. Mm-hmm. You know, they're mad at the world. They're mad that they have to be there. And they're not going to show gratitude. And that actually when they can show gratitude, it's a sign of real development and growth.
Right.
And I needed to take it in. And when I could, it was very moving. And we're very close now, and she's the best part of my life. You know, I wish more people could or would take in foster kids, because not out of altruism necessarily, but out of, you know, the gift that it really is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Even though you don't have to go through diapers, you know, you get this great person. You get this great person in your life, you know.
But you've been involved. It hasn't all been easy, because raising any child is not easy, right?
Been. But I'm in the solid days now, you know. I'm in the good part of good, you know.
Well, let's start with, I wasn't going to start here, but now that we've heard her story, because I was reading in your book the number of people who are in the system and they're older and they're not finding homes, and so they maybe have a situation which is as bad as Chris, being bounced around here and there, places she shouldn't have been. And the number of these young people who wind up homeless, I didn't know that. It's a huge number.
Right. And, you know, the reason is, I think one of the things I found writing the book was that, you know, in 1997, Clinton passed the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and that was by and large a good act. What it said was that, good piece of legislation, excuse me, what it said was we can't have these kids drifting in foster care forever. We can't have these kids year after year after year after year just sitting in foster care. It was meant to be a temporary solution, so let's keep it that. So if you've been in foster care for the last 15 consecutive months out of 22 months, you need to either be adopted or sent back home. So let's do that. So what happened was we brought the numbers of foster care kids way down. We're now at 400,000, which is much better than we have been. But it changed the numbers. So the little kids and the babies got adopted, basically. So and what that means is that older kids are not. There's the teenagers are not getting adopted. We're not finding homes for them. And so it's become a system that's really, really full of older kids. After the after ASFA passed some years later, we passed legislation, the Chafee Act, which put a lot more funding into teen services. But the teen services were mostly life skills classes, skills to help them, quote, age out, and not into finding them families, which in my personal belief, we really need to find them. We need to find them homes because they don't need skills as much. We don't need to teach them how to balance a checkbook. We don't need to teach them how to, you know, sign a lease on an apartment. These are all practical skills. But what kids really need is someone to lean on. I mean, you know, when you think about getting your first job, losing your first job, finding your first boyfriend, losing your first boyfriend, all of these basic humps that you go through in life, you don't need a thing. You need a person to call. And you need that when you're 21 and 24 and 28. And kids that don't have it really, really stumble. And, yeah, the homeless statistics are incredible. There are some statistics. I mean, the trouble is in foster care, we don't track the kids directly. We don't always know. We don't follow them afterwards. Basically, when they hit 18 or 21, they sign a paper, and we don't follow them after that. But what we do see is in the homeless shelters and often in criminal justice systems, we say, how many of you have been in foster care? And the numbers are enormous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are.
And so what we need to be doing, I think, is really looking at these kids and saying, you know, let's find them homes because they're, you know, they're great kids and they need it and they deserve it.
Well, you certainly don't want their life to be in jeopardy, for heaven's sake. Right.
Yeah.
Let's start with a decision. When a decision is made to remove a child from his or her home, you start your book with this really amazing story, because I would assume that you were going to say, when you talk about 2-year-old Alicia, that she was removed from her house, but she wasn't. Could you tell us that story and how you reached the decision that you reached that maybe it wouldn't be a good idea to move her out of her apartment?
Oh, well, I start with this quandary, basically. I know I just started in my own building. You know, I think that often people think about foster care, and some people don't, but some people think about foster care as sort of other. But foster care is really everywhere. So I just started in my own building where I have there's a little girl who, you know, her parents always leave her. I live in New York City, and her parents always leave her outside in the hallway for hours. In her stroller, like when she's asleep, they just leave her in the hallway, and it's because they're hoarders, and they can't get her her stroller through the into the house, into the apartment. So they'll leave her out there, and it's a fairly safe building, so I'm not so worried that she's going to necessarily be kidnapped. But you know, it is New York City, and she's out there by herself, and if she cries, her parents don't hear her, and she's in, you know, sitting in a hallway alone.
Right.
The New York City apartment building. It's not great. And then you look in her apartment, and it's, you know, floor to ceiling, fire hazard, and smell, and disgusting, and all, you know, it's not a great way to grow up.
No.
However, the trauma that happens when a child is removed from her parents is immense. You know, so this is a case where I personally, you know, have known a lot about child welfare. It depends on where you are. I don't want to make blanket statements. You know, each city, each county, each state differs from place to place. So some places are better than others. But it's not a clear case where you say, you know what, this isn't a great situation for this kid. Let's remove her for a while and help the parents out, and then we'll put her back. That's been sort of the traditional thinking about foster care. But what you see is, as soon as you remove that child, the trauma that kid goes through is is incredible because she panics. I mean, she gets taken. That's what her life in that very messy, fire hazard filled home is what she knows, you know?
Right.
And the thing is, putting her into foster care depends on where she goes. Even if she goes with a loving family for a while, she has an attachment to her biological parents, and that's very, very real.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's neglect that's going on. Is it horrible? Maybe, maybe not.
Right,
you know, I mean,
right.
Ideally, we'd get some real support in there to shore up that family and get the house cleaner, find out what's going on. I mean, it's tricky because hoarding is a very complicated, you know, mental illness, and
right.
You need a lot of support services in there. But you know, it's not a simple answer of just take the kid away because it's going to cause a lot of damage down the line.
So who makes the decision, Chris, as to whether it is significant abuse or it is significant neglect and the child must be removed?
Well, what happens is generally somebody makes a call. So if I had made a call or if someone in my building makes a call, and the truth is anyone can make a call. If I'm a mandated reporter, I'm supposed to make a call. So if I'm a social worker, if I'm a teacher, if I'm a doctor, if I'm a police person, there are so-called mandated reporters who by law are mandated to make a call, and they call an 800 number, they call a child abuse hotline, et cetera. And what that does is it goes to the local, in my case it would go to the Administration for Child Services, goes to the local agency, right? And the agency then sends out what's called an investigator to look at the house, right, and look at the family. If the child's old enough, they interview the child, and then they interview the parents separately, and they make a decision. Now, there aren't black and white rules, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some guidelines, and the guidelines differ, and they decide whether it's abuse or not, or whether it's neglect. 70% of the cases of child maltreatment are neglect cases. There are those that argue that neglect is another word for poverty. In the case of the child in my building, it's not a poverty issue. My building is not impoverished, although the family may be poor. But what happens is then an investigator comes in and decides, you know, how bad is this? And if it's a case of immediate danger, they can yank the child right there. They can come in without a warrant, and they can decide to just take the child in a police car or in a van and take the child to an agency. And they make that decision, you know, based on some guidelines, some experience, some gut instinct.
Right.
Sometimes they call a supervisor, you know. And so there's a lot of gray area. There's a top commissioner in Florida who did a study of his investigators in the state to see, like, who did removals and why. And what he found was the rate of removals didn't have to do with the kind of abuse that was going on in the home, but with the level of experience of the investigators. And the ones with the least experience removed at far higher rates than those with more experience. And which kind of makes sense. I mean,
sure.
Investigators tend to be very young. I mean, they're very low-paying jobs. You know, kids get them, not kids, but, you know, people get them right out of college. And when you're young, you kind of have a less nuanced kind of view of things. So you hear, huh, he hit the kid, remove the kid.
Right.
Well, there may be a little more background to that. How did he hit the kid? Did he just lose his job? How often is he hitting the kid? Is there some education that can happen here? Is there, you know, if there's serious abuse, yes. Is there exposed wiring in the house? Why is there exposed wiring in the house?
Mm-hmm.
Is the kid showing up at school without his jacket? Why?
Right.
Is the kid showing up at school because the mom is using drugs? That's one issue. Is the kid showing up at school because they don't have the money to buy a jacket? That's another issue. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's all case by case, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it we need that kind of nuance.
Chris Beam is our guest this hour. Her book is To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Chris spent 5 years looking at the child welfare system, interviewing parents and foster children, and some amazing stories, as you can imagine. She also comes to this from personal experience because she took in a foster child who she adopted, and she was a foster mom when she was only 28 years old and took in a 17-year-old who's doing just fine, thank you, now. We welcome your calls, your thoughts on all of this. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Chris Beam, To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care is what we're talking about this hour. And we go to Matthew in Summit Lake, our first caller. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Cutting out a little bit. So I would like to just call up and thank you and your guests for this because it reminds me very much of my grandparents who, after my grandma died in 1995, we learned that she had over 80 foster children.
Woo!
In her house. And, well, not all at one time, but
right.
Over many, many years, four of whom she adopted and one of whom she really wanted to adopt, but the agency said that my grandparents were too old, but I would just like to say that it was a really nice way to grow up. There's always children around, but in some ways it was sad because I remember one time my grandmother saying that she always called us little brats. You know, that was her little name for us, all of her grandchildren. And one day one of the foster children asked her, "Mother, why don't you call me a little brat?" And it was simply because she didn't want her to be taken away. That the people would know that they would hear that and then take her away from her.
Hmm. Chris.
Right. You know, that's really sad, and that speaks to, you know, it's great that your grandma did that, and it's great that it felt like such a wonderful way to grow up, and I think that so much speaks to the notion that, you know, caseworkers are, you know, there's really amazing caseworkers. There are so many that are so dedicated and so devoted to their job, and yet they have such a hard time because they're so feared, you know, by the families, by the kids sometimes, whatever. And that's, I think, what you're speaking to is this idea that, you know, if she said the wrong thing, the kids could be taken, and they could. And that still happens, you know, that there's this fear that you know, you attach to the kids and then they can get yanked away. And sometimes that happens because sometimes they're following the rules rather than following what's really happening in a nuanced way with the kids once they're in the home.
Right. Oh, those omnipresent rules, right? Rules,
right.
Rules.
Right, and that's what really causes the slow destruction of any family, foster or biological or anything in this system, is the rules. You know, when anybody's following it on a case-by-case basis and really looking and caring about the kids' attachments, then it works okay, but it's not when it's rules.
Yeah. Thanks, Matthew, very much for the call. His grandmother reminds me slightly of the story of Mary Keene, highlighted in your book, who bought this 12-bedroom Victorian house in Yonkers to provide a home for foster children. What a lovely thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, she's really a hero. She's amazing. But what she does is she takes in kids who have aged out. So, you know, 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, 23-year-olds, and really lets them live there past their, you know, their age out date. And she's great. I mean, she practices, you know, what's called, you know, loosely, it's called moral adoption. So, you know, when kids haven't been released into actual adoption, I mean, when their parents' rights haven't been terminated, she does what she calls moral adoption, which means, you know, I'm here for you forever. And sometimes kids are nervous about getting adopted, you know, often, the agencies will hold out adoption as a real sort of panacea, or as like the promise, the end of your road. You know, if you get adopted, everything will be okay. And a lot of times, kids are afraid to be adopted, or you know, really don't want it. And so sort of moral adoption is another option. And
Right. Let's, because there are so many really captivating stories, and you read them and you think, what would I do? What would I consider the right thing to do? Tell us the story of your friend Steve and Aaron and the baby, because this story is just, you struggle with the whole thing. You want the baby to stay with this family that seems to love them so much, and then you look at the birth mother, and she's struggling to become a mom, and you look at what they have to offer and what she has to offer, and yet you're still saying that tie, the biological tie, is something we have to be always aware of, and it's very, very, very important.
Right. You know, it's hard because there are no easy answers here, you know, and that's what I think just in general as an overall statement with child welfare. There are no, I mean, there are occasionally some bad guys, but there are no bad guys or good guys. There are no hero. There are a few heroes and a few villains, but really, it's just a lot of people trying to do the right thing and a lot of struggling.
Yes.
So
yes.
This is an example of that. And so, you know, I have this very good friend named Steve, and he wanted to he adopt. There's something called foster to adopt, which is, you know, you go into the you can adopt children through the foster agency, and I advocate for that. You know, that's a great option. So many people are adopting from overseas when we have plenty of children. There are 100,000 children who are available for adoption right now, right here,
mm-hmm.
who are perfectly healthy and wonderful, etc. So this is what he, you know, he and his partner planned to do, and they already had one child that they had done this with, and then they had another, and they were told that, you know, the mother had revoked her rights and given up her rights, and she and they took in this beautiful 6-month-old baby, and he was perfect, and they had him for 9 months. And then they got the call that every parent dreads, which is that she wanted the baby back. And you know, it was confusing for me writing this book, because I you know, always feel like, well, wait, the biological parents, you know, what about this is about attachment to biological parents. And then here I was with my friend who had taken in this baby, and this baby was really their baby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that point, that baby was really their baby. He had been with him for a year. He had attached to his brother. He had attached to his mom and dad, and they loved him. And it was never their intent to break up a family. You know, that was never what they. Nobody was trying to hurt anybody here. You know, and then I was hearing stories about the biological mom. And no way was she stable, you know? It wasn't like she'd had a little glitch and now she was going to be stable. She was very troubled.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly I was on the other side, you know?
Right,
And I realized how changeable everything can be. And I had a lot of compassion for it's not even just all sides. I mean, there's so many sides to this. And I saw...
Right.
And I saw how traumatizing it would be for this baby, actually, to then be moved again. I mean, he was
right.
Clearly so bonded in this family. And what would happen, you know, if he then went, you know, to another family?
Mm-hmm.
And I think so they went through visitations. The mom went up and down. It was really just very painful. And ultimately, my friends ended up keeping the baby. And I think what happened, you know, the way that I saw it unfolding was that the biological mom really couldn't deal with the pressure of the prolonged court cases. And she kind of, at the end, said, okay, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because, you know, I think my friends, you know, had they heard it from the outset, would have said, we wouldn't fight to keep a mother from her child, you know, and they weren't, they were always going to let, you know, have the mother see their kid and all this, but they also, once they had loved this child for a year,
right,
and some, they weren't going to just say, okay, here, take your baby back. They were like, wait a minute, this is our child, we've got to make sure it's okay, and wait, whoa.
I know. It's a really profound story. Let's go to some phone calls. We have many coming in. Pat in St. Croix County. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead.
Okay. I was a foster parent in St. Croix County for 22 years.
Oh.
Wow, that's great.
We fostered over 100 adolescent girls.
Wow.
And I really recognized my role as being a teacher and not a mother to these children. After I completed that career, I went back to college, got my degree, and became a child protection worker.
Oh, my.
Oh.
In Dunn County and Pierce County.
Hmm.
And I also taught parenting classes for foster parents.
Hmm.
Oh, that's great.
In both counties. But one of the things I wanted to say is I still have a relationship with 80% of my girls.
That's a lot of girls.
And I maintain that relationship through Facebook and through other, you know, through other means.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would tell the girls, you got a mom. And currently she may not be able to give you what you need, but it's my job here to make sure you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And we could never remove a child from a home when I worked in child protection. Police officers had to do the removal, and then we did the capias, meaning we found a place for the child.
Mm-hmm.
And what we looked at is, will this child be safe if I leave here today? Safety was a primary issue.
Right.
So
yeah,
sometimes, you know, people say, well, geez, the house looked like a pigsty.
Yeah.
But you looked at the age of the kids. Was it a hazard to them? Were they safe
right
in that house?
Mm-hmm. Chris.
Yeah, you know, I think you make a lot of really good points, you know, and this is where foster care is so different state by state and city by city. In some places you need to have a police officer do the actual removal, in some places you don't, you know. In some places, like in Kansas, for example, it's entirely been privatized, so private agencies go out and actually do the investigation. So, it varies state by state. And then, you know, I think what's really great about what you're saying is that, you know, and I wish I had known this when I was parenting Christina when she was younger, was the acknowledgement of the biological parent. I think this was a mistake that I really made, was Christina was, you know, in contact with her biological mom. And her biological mom, you know, Christina got put into foster care when she was 17 because of abuse. And, I mean, I'm sorry, when she was 7 because of abuse. Came to me at 17, and she would go back to her mom's house, and her mother was cruel. And then she'd come back to me and be a wreck. And I always tried to prevent her from doing that. Like, why do you do it? Here I am. I love you. I'll do it, you know. And I didn't understand that was such a fundamental need, that she needed to do that. And I've seen it now that I've written the book. I've seen kids do this all the time. They need to go back. They need to, you know, whether they're healthy or unhealthy or indifferent, these parents, the kids will maintain some kind of contact. So it's so great that you knew that already and are teaching it to your parents in your parenting classes, because I think a lot of us have this, you know, rescue complex that wants to whisk them out of their biological families. And the truth is, they're connected to those biological families no matter what.
Yeah. Well, and this is a painful time for you in your life, but it is something that I've read about and you've talked about.
Yeah.
Perhaps some of this was your perceptions were based on your leaving your mother, I believe.
Yeah.
When you were 14, you never saw her again, did you?
I never saw her. No, I never saw her again. So I think there was some, you're absolutely right, there was some, you know, kind of protection. You know, I wanted to protect my daughter from what I had gone through, and I never saw mine again, so maybe she shouldn't see hers again either, you know. So, you know, all of us go through this kind of projecting our own story onto our kids, and part of the trick is learning to see them as their own people and
mm-hmm.
letting them do what they need to go through, and detaching. And I think that's true for biological parents, foster parents, adoptive parents, you know, letting the kids really be who they are.
Right. Pat, tell me, why did you become a foster mom in the first place?
We had a neighbor girl who was being, sexually abused by somebody in her household.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up here and she talked to me. And I said, that's not okay. And so I said, I really need to call somebody because that needs to stop.
Right.
And so she went back and she told her mother that. She told me her mother got mad and kicked her out. So she came here to stay. And she was here for until, she was older. And we still have a great relationship.
Right.
And she's a great human being, turned out absolutely awesome.
I'm so glad to hear that.
It was great. And at one point we asked if we could adopt her, and her parents said no. They refused, they wouldn't sign. But we tried to rebuild that relationship in a safe environment.
Right.
She never got to go home, but we invited them here.
Oh.
For dinner once in a while or something.
Uh-huh.
So I was just whatever. Anyway, and then I got licensed and we had her.
Well, you've really lived this life, haven't you? I'm so glad you called, Pat. And it is true. I mean, not all the stories are you get your child in your house and people grow to love each other and they're with each other for the rest of their lives and you change everybody's lives around. Because of the trauma, Chris, you write about some young people who run away, and you can't quite figure out why would you run away.
Right. Yeah, I mean, kids run away. I don't know if Pat, this has happened with you, but, kids will run away sometimes even if it's, especially if it's a good situation, and often it comes from, met a lot of kids that this has happened with, because they've been put through multiple placements. They've been, there's somebody at Columbia who was a foster child in the 50s and early 60s, and then she is now a professor of psychology there, and she talks about the way that in child welfare, trauma forecloses grief, and we're really talking about grieving children. When they're removed from their parents, they're grieving, but then the trauma closes that up, and that grief just gets calcified in there.
Right.
And so what happens, we would never say to somebody at their funeral, at their husband's funeral, all right, your husband's dead, here, have a new husband, love him now, you're moving in with him today. We'd never say that to somebody, but we say that to foster kids all the time. Like, we're taking you out of your parents' house, here's a new mom, better love her, be nice to her.
Right.
And we do that to kids, and what happens is they can't. They can't attach, they're traumatized. The classic thing is they start wetting the bed if they're young. And I've heard countless ridiculous stories of parents that will send kids back because why is this 11-year-old wetting the bed? I can't have an 11-year-old wetting the bed. And they send them back to the agency. And then the kid, that sense of rejection and loss gets deepened. And then the kid hardens and they get sent to a more restrictive home and a more restrictive home. By the time they hit 17 or 18, they're just, like, really shut down.
Right.
And they're going to run away. And especially if you love them, they're going to be like, I'm going to test you.
Thank you, Pat, so much for your call. We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the foster care system in America with Chris Beam. Chris is the author of To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls now for Chris Beam, and let's go to John in Grand Rapids. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm trying to play catch-up with your guest. I heard her, I think, mention she had grown up in foster care or had been placed out of home care. Is that correct?
No. I left my mother's house when I was 14 and then went to my father's house, and so I never was placed in care at all. I just never saw my mom again, and my mother was my mom was a prostitute and very neglectful, and so I left her. And so I, in that way, I, luckily, I never was placed in care. But I thought a lot about the that kind of loss and that kind of guilt. And it always made me think about, A, why nobody called, given that I was living there alone with her, with my little brother, and B, why, how these kids sort of, you know, even when there's abuse going on, how they have that longing and that missing, how both can coexist.
Well, I actually work in the system, and I wanted to agree with you that out-of-home care, when you take a child away from a parent or a relative and place them with essentially a stranger, I don't know if the general public knows what kind of trauma that is versus whatever trauma they may be experiencing in the home. And a worker has to balance that stuff out when they're making these decisions.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's kind of hard to do when you're never parented yourself because it's a challenge. I put in a plug for foster parents. They get paid almost nothing for this work they do. I've had kids bust up, damage their homes, steal their cars, their credit cards, their underwear, everything you can imagine.
Yeah.
And foster parents are underpaid and undertrained.
I agree with you 100%.
It's just something that we need to take a look at. And I don't know if the public knows also that a lot of the kids we place in foster care, at least in Wisconsin, they're delinquents. They may have been protective services cases at one time, But they graduate into other, you know, a lot of times criminal behavior, maybe status offenses like truancy and running away from home. But, you know, some of the toughest cases I ever had were actually special needs adoptions where the special needs adoptive parent gives up on the kid. Now you have someone twice TPR'd or looking at being having parental rights terminated twice. Talk about a difficult case and rejection, you know.
Right. And if they've been twice TPR'd, meaning termination of parental rights.
He's adopted parents.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
exactly. This is a child that's deeply, deeply traumatized. This is a child, you know, and I think that there's a trend right now to talk about these dual-involved kids, meaning that they're involved in the juvenile justice system and the child welfare system, you know, as sort of a... You know, this just happened in New York City. We've just combined child welfare and juvenile justice. We've made them one agency because there's sort of a and everybody's lauding it. Everybody's saying, oh, this is great, you know, because now we can give these kids sort of joint services. But it's in a way, it's a presumption that, and the numbers bear it out, that these kids will start in child welfare and end up in juvenile justice. But I think we need to really think about, ideally, we need to think about why is this happening again and again? Why is there such a pipeline? And I think it's a really multi-determined answer.
Mm-hmm.
A very nuanced, complicated answer. And I also think we need to think about it from the other end and say, well, what would happen? I mean, this is a little idealistic, hippie sounding, but what would happen if we combined child welfare with the library system? What if kids were dual involved that direction? You know, what if we just started thinking that way?
Why not? Yeah, why not? John, thanks for the call. Mike in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Yes, I retired from law enforcement after 30 years here last year. And during my time as a police officer, I saw many cases kind of on the flip side of foster uh-huh. families that were hosting kids specifically for a paycheck. They had absolutely
right.
nothing, no interaction with those kids. Most of the time we were dealing with issues and neglect. We'd make these complaints and nothing would ever happen to these families. They would just be moved from one city to another and those kids would still remain with those foster parents. And I remember seeing something in the State Journal here not too long ago about this abuse of this foster system and wonder if that system has gotten any better or are they doing anything different now to check on these parents who take on these kids or become foster parents for these kids to make sure that's not what they're doing.
Well, you know, it's a really great question. And one of the things that I was shocked by when I started digging into the research of this is we have a tremendous amount of data on the foster kids themselves. And not necessarily what happens to them when they age out. I mean, we do it retroactively the way I mentioned, but tremendous amount of data on who they are, where they come from, their demographics, et cetera. Almost none on the foster parents. Like, literally, just a few states, we have a few little studies on who they are, but no national picture of who these foster parents are, and most of the studies are anecdotal. So we really don't know in the big picture who the foster parents are, whether it's changed over time. It varies tremendously state by state. Some states require, like, for example, in New York State, we require 30 hours, basically, of parent training. Different states require 0 hours. Some require annual renewals of your parent trainings. So different states varies. So there's no real way, in answer to your question, to check whether foster parents are getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear all the time of, you know, foster parents, quote, doing it for the money. I think that they're, and then on the other side, we hear what the previous caller said, which is that foster parents are entirely underappreciated, and undervalued, and that's true too. I mean, I think we need to pay foster parents more and value them more, actually, ironically, and then we will get do away with these ones kind of doing it for the money, because the kids are being it's horrific the way that they're treated in some homes. There are many, many subpar homes, unfortunately. They're the horrific ones you hear about on the news, where the parents are, you know, beating them and abusing them and even killing them. But there are far too many sort of mediocre homes where the parents actually don't care and are not doing much. They're just sort of getting by, these sort of mediocre flatlands.
Right.
And then there are the amazing, amazing homes.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe the woman that called in. There are wonderful places, there are horrific places, and then there are far too many sort of just okay, where they're just giving them a bed and some food and a roof.
Mm-hmm. You know? Let's talk a little bit about the system. You talk about Florida in the book and Florida's foster care system with a different kind of funding, maybe a better funding than other states, and say that this is something that other states and counties have also applied for. What happened in 2006?
Well, it's interesting because this is, you know, I talk about this because I think that we often think of foster care as like a sort of static thing that never changes and, oh, no, it's terrible and it's never going to get better. But I think there are things that are really changing, like in Florida and maybe some other states, too. And so what happened in Florida in 2006 is they changed the way they're funding. They funded it. The way that foster care is traditionally funded in most places is on a per diem basis, meaning that you need to remove a child in order to get your money from an individual agency takes a kid, gets a kid, and then requests money from the city, which requests it from the state, which requests it from the federal government. It's a whole lot of bean counting, basically. And so the child needs to be removed to get that money. And every day that the child is in care, the agency gets money. There are a lot of people that are against this or have argued against it because they say it's a perverse incentive to remove children. That's the only way we're going to get funded. So what Florida did in 2006 was they said, you know what, we're going to ask for a flat sum, which they called a waiver. And I mean, I'm oversimplifying here, but basically it was to the tune of around $140 million a year for 5 years. They got a waiver, and they didn't have, so they could do with it, with caveats, what they pleased. And so they could, instead of having to remove the children, they could put the money into front-end services. They could put it into child abuse prevention, domestic violence, drug abuse, whatever, all these neighborhood services and so on. And so far the numbers look, when we're looking at numbers, not stories, but the numbers look really good. They've reduced the numbers of kids in care. And in 2011, Obama opened it up and said, you know, more states can apply. There are 30 states and cities and counties that have applied for this waiver system. So I think we're going to see a big kind of sea change in the way that we approach foster care.
Mm-hmm.
The risk with this, of course, is that it's less individualized. In that, you know, when you're getting certain individual funding for each individual kid and each kind of bed, you're really specifically tailoring it, ideally, to each child. When you get lump sums, you may sort of tailor it to the cheapest common denominator, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the risk with waivers. But I'm really hopeful about it. I think it's going to go toward preventive rather than having to remove the children.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let's just take a brief comment. That's all we have time for. Kate in Fond du Lac, can you do it in 30 seconds?
I'll try my best.
Thank you.
Hi. My husband and I just came back from Denver, Colorado, where we volunteered at a camp for kids in foster care that reunites them with their siblings called Camp Tubalon. And I just was hoping your guests could maybe talk about sibling connections and the importance of that.
All right. And you'll have to do that in 10 seconds.
Sibling connection is vital. We need to keep these families together. That is so great you did that.
Oh, you both did so well. Thanks, Kate, so much. Chris, thank you. Thanks for writing the book, too. It's an important one. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Beam, the book is To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Great conversations ahead, and we'll be with you again tomorrow, our relatively new time slot, 1 to 3 in the afternoon. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.